the ticking time bomb of tension, which could explode into a conflict.
We were walking right on the edge.
This world would be a pretty easy and fun place to live if everybody just minded his own business.
We were walking right on the edge.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Inside Track. My name is David Condon. I'll now introduce to you Jason Kennedy. Hello, Jason. How you doing, man?
Oh, very well, Dave. Thank you.
Right, excellent. So, new week, new show. Before we start, let me just explain where you can contact us. If you'd like to make your way over to bookarmor.com, that's bookarmor.com, and you shall see a wonderful website built by Jason, highlighting all our previous topics and everything that we've covered so far. There's also ways to communicate with us. We have a C-box, which is http://mycbox.ws, inside a track. And also a new website, Defiant Radio has now got its own website, and we have a page on it, Inside Track. So that's defiantradiouk.com/inside track. Go and fill your boots. So, Jay, how's your week been, man?
It's developing into a monster week, Dave.
Oh, pray tell.
Two developments this week. The first one was planned and the second one was not planned. The planned part is my wife has gone to China, right. Not on a permanent basis.
She's not immigrated then.
She's not being deported or sent away or left me.
Right, okay.
I'm in Taiwan. For anyone listening for the first time, I'm in Taiwan. And she's gone across the Taiwan Strait on a business trip to China for the next few days. So she went on her way just this morning. So that's the planned part. And of course, I've got all the natural kind of concern about her trip there. But she did arrive safely. She hadn't disappeared like MH370. So that part was good. The unplanned part is I think I may be about to pass another kidney stone. Could do it on air, actually. That would be interesting for people to listen to.
That'd see if we'd improve our feedback level.
Well, if I do start screaming uncontrollably during the show, that will be the reason why. It's not that I'm having a psychotic breakdown. But two things there. One, the wife will give me a report on how China was. She hasn't been there for more than 5 or 6 years, I believe. So when she comes back, maybe she can clue me in on how things have kind of changed in the interim. So that may be next week. And then with the kidney stone, like I say, that's just her cloud hanging over this show so people can continue to listen and just kind of wait for that. It's a suspense thing.
Yeah, it's like, will it drop or will it not?
And for anyone who's listening who's had a kidney stone, I've already passed one, so I'm not a virgin. And I'm sure I'll have their sympathy because the pain does rival labor pains.
Is it? Yeah, I've heard it's similar to labor pains.
Except labor pains don't usually last 3 days and nights, which mine did last time.
Well, that depends on I know some people do.
It is one of those things where people will offer advice while you're in agony. You know, it's that kind of thing where I don't know why, but people like to offer people advice when they're in agony about things that they can do or things that they can try, when really you've lost all ability to focus on anything other than what's going on inside your body. So I do remember my wife was continuing to sort of nag me as I was screaming in the hospital. That wasn't really that good. I was just yelling and shouting about how I had a kidney stone and it would be a great idea if they found drugs and administered them.
Right, okay.
To myself, not to themselves. You know, they put earplugs in or something like this. That would be the NHS response these days, I think. I just pop some earplugs in. Can't hear you at all, Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah, nothing seems to be wrong at all.
Yeah, I feel fine.
So, what's the first topic on the table for discussion? I understand it's the general election. Dun, dun, dun.
Dum, dum, dum.
Yeah. Interesting, though, on Tuesday when Theresa May broke this information, Goldman Sachs released some information. Did you catch any wind of that at all, Jay?
No, I didn't catch that story at all. Understandably, I was organising a street party to celebrate the Theresa May's announcement.
Oh, right.
Waving my Union Jack flag in the street outside and accosting people on the street and urging them to join me in the mission, which has now been the gauntlet has been thrown down, you know, that we now have 5 weeks to work to overturn this government. So no, I was kind of lost in all the speculation about the announcement. So what was Goldman Sachs?
They released their figures for the last quarter, and they're down their predictions so much so that it's been touted as the worst figures since they've been floated on the stock exchange in about 19 years. So something's seriously going wrong with Goldman Sachs at the moment. Obviously, some people would associate Goldman Sachs with the beginnings of the 2007/2008 crash, where the derivative market decided to fold up on itself. So, yeah, interesting that they're having hard times.
I do feel sorry for those guys. Imagine if they had to take a pay cut.
Oh, yeah, only 1 million this month.
Imagine if they're paying themselves less of our money. That would be absolutely terrible.
Isn't that considerate?
These are the guys who pop champagne when thousands of people lose their jobs and the stock price like jumps up or there's a merger or a takeover. Difficult to feel much sympathy for these guys. The ones I respect are the ones who, when the rug does get pulled out from under them and they're faced with the prospect of returning to a kind of the life that the rest of us lead, find it completely impossible to countenance and leap from the nearest expensive hotel window. Those guys are the ones I admire.
So before we get down into this nitty-gritty of the election thing, I have a couple of bonus clips. So this morning, Douglas Carswell released a statement, right? And this is what he said.
And a statement has just appeared from Douglas Carswell. Let me just take you through that. He says, I have done everything possible to ensure we got and won a referendum to leave the European Union, even changing parties and triggering a by-election to help nudge things along. Last summer, we won that referendum. He goes on, I have decided that I will now not be seeking re-election. I intend to vote Conservative on the 8th of June and will be offering my full support to whoever the Clacton constituency Conservatives select as their candidate. He says, it is time said that all political careers end in failure. It doesn't feel like that to me today. I have stood for Parliament 5 times, won 4 times and helped win the referendum last June. Job done. I'm delighted.
Job done. Move on. Oh, and full circle back to the Conservative Party.
Was that clip cutting out for you? Because that was cutting out for me.
No, it wasn't cutting out here.
Do you remember that stand-up comedian? He was called Norman Collier.
Yes, the one that got...
His entire act was based around his microphone not working, wasn't it? To me, that sounded just like Norman Collier was reading that out. Right.
Well, basically, what he's suggesting is that he's not going to stand anymore. He was going to be standing as an independent. He's no longer going to be standing as an independent. He's going to support and vote for the Conservative Party, which is basically where he started.
And that will be one vote, I presume, at the ballot box.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'm not really sure why Douglas Carswell feels the need to come out with a statement as if he's some major world historical figure to tell us he's going to go and post one vote in a box.
Yeah, well, this is Douglas or whatever.
It is good of him, I suppose.
Yeah, to go back crawling to the Conservatives. Lovely.
He's going to be wearing a big, a bright purple suit with in yellow letters stitched across the front and back. I am Douglas Carswell. That's what he'll be wearing to the ballot station, the polling station, sorry. Does seem rather to be overestimating his importance.
Yes, yes, Mr. Twisty-Faced. So?
I've never seen his face, actually.
No? You should. In fact, it would be really good for the listeners to check out your reaction. Google his face now. Because...
And just make a sound.
It's an interesting...
I'll have a look.
Yeah.
I can describe him, I suppose.
Yeah.
I can try.
Do a visual, for radio.
Something. Yeah.
Theatre for the Mind.
I'll tell you who he reminds me of when his mug pops up.
Gannon. He's got an interesting profile.
Has he got two noses?
No. Does look like he's his face is designed to go around corners, I think.
He looks like a policeman.
Yeah. It's like some weird clown face. But
and the bottom of his face doesn't look like it belongs with the top of his.
That's exactly what face. I mean. That is twisty face.
It looks like a rugby ball. It looks like a rugby ball with some ears stuck on the side.
There you go. And I think that me and the listeners were...
I don't mean to be mean, but his mouth kind of goes down 45 degrees to one side. So that looks very strange.
It's a face only a mother could love, maybe. Right?
It's kind of easy to imagine him saying things. I'm surprised by that statement. He looks more like a, you know, like I say, a policeman or one of those American kind of drill instructors or something like this.
Well, it's like you get one of those mirrors, you get in the, you know, crazy hall of mirrors. He'll actually look normal if he stood in front of you.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, when we look in the back of a spoon, when he looks in the back of a spoon, he thinks, well, what are people talking about? It just looks the same.
Yeah, well, this is it. Anyway, enough ridiculing. Enough ridiculing the poor, twisty-faced fool. So, where do we start? I mean... It's a huge thing, election, June the 8th. So, like you say, we've got 5 weeks. It's interesting. All the talking heads are now coming out saying for and against. So where would you like to start on this one, NJ?
Well, one thing I would say is I'm kind of glad that there's going to be an election. Right. I was kind of worried that if Theresa May did not call this election and she ground it out until 2020, that by that time the Blairite faction inside the Labour Party would have performed such feats of skullduggery, I suppose, that the Labour Party would be even more in even greater trouble than it is now, and also that Jeremy Corbyn may never have been given his chance to go to the country and see how he performs, in spite of his many of his own party doing everything they can to sabotage him since he became leader. So I'm glad that Jeremy Corbyn's going to get his chance. If they allowed a born loser like Ed Miliband to run his course and perform abysmally, then it doesn't hurt to let Jeremy Corbyn have a try. I'm still not in agreement with people that seem to believe that Jeremy Corbyn is somehow orders of magnitude worse than Ed Miliband. I thought Ed Miliband, it wasn't hard to guess the result at the last election. Were you in any doubt? Did you ever think Ed Miliband could win?
No. The little memes that were put out about him, the bacon sandwich eating thing, that was hilarious. Do you know what I mean? He shot himself in the foot multiple times, so no, I don't think anyone really accepted that he would win. I wouldn't have thought anyway.
I don't think Ed Miliband really believed he could win.
Well,
I'm not really sure why he was in the job. I did appreciate the fact that he's even... Ed Miliband is... He's not a fool, but he has a kind of benign side to him. He had a kind of... comedy act almost of sending himself up as this kind of nerdy wonky guy when he came out. He made a joke about taking off his shirt like Vladimir Putin and said, you know, I think I'm the kind of guy who keeps his shirt on, things like this. Yeah, it was good. It kind of knockabout stuff of an altogether different kind to his brother, who really is one from the shadows. So I was glad when Ed Miliband, his greatest act of service to the Labour Party was to prevent his brother from becoming leader.
Yeah, right. So just to get the ball rolling, let's have a listen to what Theresa May. Now, this is from Radio 4's Today programme, and she gives a little bit more detail as to why she decided to call a snap election after the last several months, basically saying that she wasn't going to go near it, and it came to most people as a bit of a shock. She gives some interesting opinions.
When I became Prime Minister last July, I felt that the most important thing was stability for the country. We'd had the referendum, which had come out with a result in terms of voting to leave the EU that hadn't been expected. Obviously, David Cameron had resigned. I'd taken over as Conservative Party leader and Prime Minister. And I felt it was important to have a period of stability at that stage and to ensure that the British people could have confidence that their government was going to deliver on what they voted for, which was leaving the European Union. And so getting through that process of the early work of preparation for and then triggering Article 50 was very important. When it came to triggering Article 50, around that time, it became clear the extent to which the opposition parties in Westminster were intent on what I would describe as frustrating the Brexit process, because Brexit isn't just about the letter that says we want to leave. It's about negotiating the deal. It's about getting the right deal from Europe. And, you know, when we've been told by the Liberal Democrats they want to grind Parliament, the government to a standstill, Labour threatened to vote against the deal, the SNP, the Scottish Nationalists saying they would vote against us legislating to leave the European Union. I felt it was important that the country is united. I think there's a unity of purpose in the country.
You're blaming the opposition for your change of mind. I mean, you've changed your mind. You said something and you're now saying exactly the opposite. And let's be clear, it is only a matter of weeks ago that you said in Scotland, now is not the time, you said. All our energies should be focused on our negotiations with the European Union. Everything you've just described, you knew when you said that.
Yeah. What we are now going to be able to do, I believe, with this election, is actually strengthen our position in terms of our negotiations with the European Union. I think people have a unity of purpose. The public want us to actually deliver on leaving the European Union, and they want us to build that stronger Britain for the future beyond leaving the European Union. That's what having an election now, it gives us that opportunity for stability and certainty.
The interesting point that she made there about blaming almost the reason she's doing it is to stop the other parties sabotaging the Brexit negotiations. And from all accounts, the timeline would be, if an election wasn't called now, it would be coming up for election just at that critical moment when we're supposed to be negotiating the best deal for Britain to leave the EU. So this is her rationale for doing it now. What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, I think there's probably something in that. If they have it now and the Tories win, then they'll be able to say later that there's no need to have this kind of referendum on the deal, which some people were pushing for. Not reversing the Brexit decision, but this idea of a referendum on the deal that was kind of a deal or no deal.
Yeah.
That will be unnecessary, basically, if she has this election. The other thing there that's kind of interesting, though, is, like you say, she's got the saboteur idea. I think it's the Daily Mail had this headline, didn't they?
Right.
Crush the saboteurs, presenting the democratically elected opposition as a kind of fifth column working against the interests of the government of the day, which actually is the business of every opposition.
Yeah.
To work against the government of the day. Unless it's in an actual time of war, we might move on, you know, it moves on to a different footing then. We often have a kind of government of national unity. You know, it's kind of clear then that we have to come together, the political class and the citizens of the country too.
Yeah.
However, we're not quite at war at the minute. The other interesting thing there is she said it two or three times, this unity of purpose that Theresa May has somehow, what would we say, felt. I don't know if she just reached out of Downing Street out of a window and extended her fingertips and began to feel trembling in the air, in the ether. I feel the unity of purpose. I will call a snap election. Or if she has a crystal ball.
Yeah, silence.
I haven't heard anything about this unity of purpose. I've never seen it. I don't know what scientific instrument you might measure it with. Would it be controversial if I suggested that the place where this unity of purpose first sprang into existence is within the mind of Theresa May or one of her advisers? I don't think there's anything actually out there. The Brexit vote kind of split the nation down the middle. The idea that suddenly everyone has discovered a unity of purpose. It's kind of a little bizarre.
Yeah, it's... I don't think that there's basically that much unity going on in this country at the moment. And the fact that she's touting this... what I noticed yesterday, she was doing a speech in Bolton. And obviously we know she's been called a coward recently because she's not going to be doing any TV debates, because the reason is that she's no good at them. And when given proper questions, she's not going to be in a situation where she's going to be able to give a truthful answer. You only have to watch her performance in the Prime Minister's Questions every Wednesday. And she is only effective when she's trying to belittle people, it seems, in this case, Jeremy Corbyn, most of the time. But yesterday, she was doing a speech. She was ushered in on stage, delivered the speech, and was ushered out on the processes of leaving the building. She would occasionally shake a hand or two, but was not asked any questions whatsoever. So I think that's going to be generally the way things are going to run over the next 50 or so days, where there's going to be PR releases that will be suggesting what Theresa May thinks about this subject or indeed that subject, but you're not actually going to be given the opportunity to ask her directly.
Yes, I would go along with that. We did point out on the show, an earlier show, that Craig Murray, the former UK ambassador, he had pointed out that he believed, and he wrote this, I think, maybe a month or so ago, we did mention it. He said he believed that already the Tories were plotting a way to avoid having any leadership debates. Because as you said, the Tories were acutely aware of kind of two things. One, Theresa May absolutely hopeless at debate.
Yeah.
There's a story I read that when she was at Oxford, she wasn't able to join the Oxford Debating Society. Instead, she belonged to one of these kind of second tier affairs where instead of the heavyweight stuff, they focus more on kind of humor. I don't think she really majors in humor either. Like you said, her idea of humor seems to be trying to make people cry with her comments.
Yeah.
Really seemed to be that witty.
Yeah.
But Craig Murray has been kind of vindicated in his view, and he said what we're going to see here, as you just said, he terms it the cotton wool election. And Theresa May will be kind of transported from location to location in front of carefully vetted audiences with carefully scripted words to pronounce upon whichever policy she's referring to. And the idea will be that there's no actual exploration of what would we call it, ideas. And there's no chance to challenge her, basically. One thing we may see, and actually, to be fair, New Labour also got involved with this too, with this kind of the news management approach to politics, is that if anyone does try to kind of intervene or pin her with any kind of question at all, if it's just a member of the public, we might get to see some kind of security alert and someone being dragged away as a and being lumped into the same box as a kind of lone wolf kind of attacker. So I think people will be taken down pretty swiftly during this campaign if they do try to, what would we say, make their way through the cotton wool.
Well, you know, interestingly you say that, because yesterday in Bolton, the people that were had been invited to this event were Conservative Party faithful. These were exactly those people that Murray would suggest would be invited, and yet she was still not allowed to answer any questions, I would assume.
Well, that is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the other thing we should mention is that the right-wing media is a great, is the insulating fabric. The right-wing media is the cotton wool.
Yeah.
Because we can be sure that even if May, inevitably during an election campaign, there are these unguarded moments, there are mistakes, there are embarrassing just situations that arise, we can be absolutely sure that the right-wing media will be distracting public attention away from any of these that Theresa May happen to make. And we can, as you said, with the bacon sandwich and Ed Miliband. Now, I wasn't a fan of Ed Miliband, but I've got no animosity towards him. And how he eats a bacon sandwich, I'm going to be honest, it doesn't matter in terms of choosing the future leader of the country. And for the papers to try and make it matter and to ridicule someone, yeah, I think we'll see that whatever Jeremy Corbyn does, if his tie is out of position, well, he's kind of slovenly. If his tie is in position, well, look at you. Aren't you a little nerd with your tie in position? It won't matter what Jeremy Corbyn does, as we've already seen. It can be manufactured. Any particular incident can be seized upon. I think we might see a lot of kind of set piece kind of activities to kind of trap him and embarrass him. We've already sort of seen evidence of that with Blairites kind of positioning people to ask him kind of embarrassing questions, or just basically to link him with particular issues, as we saw with, for example, the anti-Semitism charade that's been winding its way through the Labour Party for the last year or so. So yes, Theresa May has the right-wing media to insulate her, while Jeremy Corbyn's going to be exposed to the full force of their scorn over the coming months.
So
sorry, not coming months, coming weeks that will feel like months.
Yeah, it will be. Right, so interesting that you mentioned there how Jeremy Corbyn is being basically constantly undermined, right, by his own party, it seems. So let's have a listen to Dan Hodges.
When you have opinion poll leads, we've had three opinion polls giving the Conservatives a 21-point lead. It would almost be a dereliction of her duty as leader of the Conservative Party not to take advantage of that. And when you have people like Dan now saying, as a Labour man through and through all his life, that he's going to vote Conservative at this election, that underlines why Theresa May took the decision she did correctly.
Right, so just to set this up, that was Tim Montgomery. He is a Tory commentator, basically. So he's all in, hence he's blown smoke up Theresa May, saying how great she is. Now, he's just accused someone who's a hardcore Labour supporter, in this case Dan Hodges, that he's actually going to vote for Conservatives. Let's see what he says afterwards.
Is that true? You're going to vote Conservative?
Yeah, I mean it.
And that's to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, is it?
It's not to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, it's just that the country faces a straight choice. I mean, there are two potential prime ministers. One is Jeremy Corbyn, the other is Theresa May. Whatever Theresa May's drawbacks are, it's quite clear Jeremy Corbyn is not fit to be prime minister of the country. So that in a sense, I feel I'm not really being given any choice.
So you are really voting to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, I'm voting to stop Jeremy Corbyn being prime minister. That's how I would frame it.
That's how you'd frame it. All right.
So, yeah, that's how he's framing it. And he stuttered there. Filling on the spot there, Dan. Right, so, yeah. People who are supposed
Well, I do have to say that... Oh, sorry, Dave. I'm going to talk about Dan Hodges, right?
Go on. Yeah, because you know him.
Well, people who don't know about Dan Hodges, he's got a long track record. I would take his idea that he's a Labour man through and through with a real pinch of salt if you go and look at some of the columns he's written. He first came to my notice when he was writing for the Daily Telegraph, a well-known left-wing organ. And basically, his entire mission was constantly attacking the Labour Party and particularly the leadership and the election of Jeremy Corbyn. He's absolutely full of an insane dislike for him. And now he's found his spiritual home, the Daily Mail, where he now writes similar kinds of articles that are demonizing Jeremy Corbyn. Dan Hodges is a little like Nick Cohen, who writes for The Guardian, in that they're kind of like left-wing attack dogs, but I'm not really sure that they really are left-wing. I think they're just kind of, I wouldn't call them wolves in sheep's clothing, but you can read their articles and decide for yourself. Dan Hodges has been completely into this anti-Semitism kind of false flag operation that the Israelis have been running against the Labour Party. So he wrote an article just last week, and it said, I'll read you the headline. You can decide if a Labour man would say this or not. This is the day after Ken Livingstone was only suspended for a year from the Labour Party. I use the word only there. No, not really. You know, you can take that under your point. But his headline was... Daily Mail. If you're still a member of Labour tomorrow, you are racist.
Really?
Okay, so that was his piece on the 9th of April 2017. So you can decide for yourself if that's a Labour member speaking. And he repeats all of these anti-Semitism slurs here and some deliberate like misinformation there. Now, the other thing I'd like to say about Dan Hodges is if we wind it forward a week, as if that wasn't kind of astonishing enough, but I just want to show how acute Dan Hodges' kind of political sense is and also his thrilling Westminster connections. Because Dan Hodges just on the 16th of April wrote this amazing article here, and its thrust was this: Brexit then exit? Theresa May won't call an election, claim some ministers. Why? Because they say she just doesn't enjoy being PM and is already planning to quit. So Dan's big scoop last week was how there wasn't going to be a snap election. And then 2 days later, Theresa May stood there and announced a snap election. So that just gives you an idea of how on the ball and in the know Dan Hodges is.
So he'll just change his tune whenever he feels like it. And actually, whatever he changes it to, it's nonsense, basically. He's just a mouthpiece.
He was really against Brexit, so he wrote a lot of stuff about Brexit as well. But now he's kind of in for it for some kind of soft Brexit, and he believes that with May at the controls, that will be the best way to have the Brexit. As I said, he's not really. He's always attacking Labour from the right, and his position is so far right that he may as well just be a Tory. If you read the articles and you took away his little biog that he puts there, that he's a former like shop steward and things like this, if you just take that away and just read it for what it is, it just reads like any other kind of right-wing commentator. And actually, it's to the right of some of the supposedly kind of conservative commentators. For example, one person, I don't share all his beliefs, but for example, the Daily Mail has Peter Hitchens, doesn't it, writing for them?
Yeah.
Now, Peter Hitchens is a heavyweight compared to Dan Hodges. And Peter Hitchens' pieces are often quite insightful. Even if you don't agree with them, there's an intellect there and they're kind of coherent. As you said, he doesn't just bounce around from one thing to the next, just attacking whoever he's kind of ordered to.
Yeah.
Dan Hodges just goes wherever he's told. You know, I think there's like a trail of peanuts or something that he follows.
Peanuts, yeah, that would be nice. So even Nigel Farage was asked, I think it was this morning, again on the Radio 4 Today programme, interviewed by John Humphreys. He was asked whether he was going to stand. Now, whether he's going to stand or not is a different matter, but it was John Humphreys who's the presenter. He tried to belittle him a little bit about why he tried standing, obviously, before, and he didn't get anywhere. Let's have a listen.
Haven't decided yet. I've got to weigh it up. I am still leading a group in the European Parliament where, of course, ultimately there will be a veto over the whole Brexit deal and where the negotiations will take place over the next 2 years. And I've got to weigh up, you know, where am I best to be in terms of having an impact on Brexit and perhaps warning the British public that it's not going in the direction it should be? Am I better off staying in Strasbourg or better off trying to go to Westminster?
Well, from the point of view of UKIP, it's perfectly clear what you're better off doing, and that is staying in this country or returning, if you like, to this country and standing in a by-election, which you, in an election, a general election, which you yourself have said you'd win.
I think I would, yes. I mean, I would not have in that constituency.
You lost it last time, of course.
Perhaps in circumstances that weren't entirely fair, but we'll let the Crown Prosecution Service decide about that.
Yeah, so the Crown Prosecution Service. Maybe that should be our next topic. So, moving on.
Well, hold on there, though. I want to ask you one thing.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
Has Nigel Farage got some? Has he got some way to carry on getting like the EU money for the next couple of years? I thought that they were going to lose their contingent of MEPs. When does that happen? I really have to check when that date is. But it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Doesn't ever want to take his head out of that EU trough, because you get very little being an MP compared to being out there in the European Parliament. And he seems to like kind of European women to hunker down with as well. So a lot more kind of talent available for him out there in Brussels than he can find walking around the mean streets of South Thanet on a Friday night.
South Thanet is a place.
I've got no idea where it is, but if Nigel Farage is around there, it's a place to avoid.
It's in Kent, I do believe. It's interesting that he brings up, you know, John Humphreys, the presenter, basically tries to belittle him, saying, well, you lost there. Well, the reason he lost there was because of the Conservative by-election fraud that's now being frantically investigated by the CPS. Sorry, Jay, go on.
Well, this was one of the first thoughts I had when I read Theresa May announcing the election was this a way to put to bed this election fraud investigation? Because if we go into a general election in 5 weeks and the Crown Prosecution Service, it's kind of its decisions maybe kind of rendered moot. And, you know, it's just a great way to kind of wish it away. For anyone who's not in touch with what this issue is, the issue is the way the Tories declared their election spending during the last general election campaign. Now, the way the rules work, and all the parties sign up to these rules, and they're not rules, they're laws, are you can have, there's a limit for the local spending during an election campaign. So in a particular constituency, you'll have a limit. Actually, the limits go up and down. I think it's related to the size of constituency. But it's not big money. A candidate can only spend somewhere between £11,000 and around £15,000 during that, you know, the kind of the intense campaigning before the actual vote. And then you also have kind of national spending. So the Conservative Central Office can deploy resources, and, you know, those have to be, it has to be promoting the party as a whole, not promoting individual candidates. So it's not a problem, for example, if a candidate in a constituency appears at an event organized by Central Office, if they're just standing there, you know, in their suit or whatever, or their dress, and they're just on the scene and the message is kind of promoting the national platform. You know, for example, the manifesto. But if they're standing there next to this battle bus, for example, which was funded by Central Office, and there's kinds of placards on display or any kind of messaging that is to do with their campaign, for example, like the name of the constituency or some kind of policy that they're running on kind of locally, like maybe, I don't know, like Save a Hospital or Save a School, whatever it is, then you get into kind of problematic area about how the spending should be allocated. And that's what happened, is the Tories were basically overspending, the local candidates were overspending, but then it was being piled onto this idea that it was national spending. And in the age of social media, people have gone back through all of the kind of Twitter feeds, Instagram, Facebook posts, and found many, many examples and news stories where costs were being incurred that should have been declared, and there's no sign of them in these MPs' declarations. The long and short is that the police became involved and they've been busily collecting evidence, and some of the forces have reached the stage of their investigations where they can pass that evidence file onto the Crown Prosecution Service, who then weigh up, you know, the likelihood of a successful prosecution against these MPs. There's around 30, I don't know if you realise this, Dave, but apparently the actual list of all of them is available now. Ah. Whereas up until a day or two ago, we were only hearing that there were two who'd outed themselves as being under investigation. So now the list is there. One of them indeed is the Tory that ran against Nigel Farage in South Thanet.
Right.
And they're on the list. So the question now would be, now those 30 names are known, what might be the strategy? The Daily Mirror has a really good explainer that I'll put up on the website. But there's different ways it could go, you know. These MPs could decide not to run again, or they could decide to run and just kind of weather the storm if they get fingered by the CPS.
There's a couple of questions I'd like to ask there, Jay. One would be, it was estimated around about 12 of those 30 individuals were MPs. How many are actually MPs out of them 30 individuals that are possibly in dock for this? Right. While you're going on that.
Dave, that my list is of 30 MPs. It's not of party officials or campaign managers. This is a straight list of 30 MPs. Now, maybe in not every case did the police find enough to pass a file to the CPS, and the actual number is supposedly maybe more likely to be 20 MPs. But one thing we need to say here is these MPs are key MPs, because the seats where the Tories overspent were all the very key marginal seats that they really needed to win. So if these by-elections were rerun, you know, these are the ones that would cause a dramatic swing. I don't think any of these seats are just comfortable, safe Tory seats. Although I do look at one in the town where I grew up, and the Tories have had a majority there since the 70s. So why they were overspending there, I don't know. That seat has been conservative for like 30 years, as long as I've been alive, basically.
Well, maybe it's one of those situations where they throw the kitchen sink in just to make sure that nothing goes wrong. Because, I mean, an interesting one of the two MPs that had been fingered for this, Carl McCartney. Well, there's an interesting scenario that could play out here. If the CPS decides to prosecute him, he's not obliged in law to stand down. So he could still stand for re-election, and he is planning on standing for re-election. And at the same time, he could still be being investigated for fraud from 2015. And yet, they would have to rely on him being a good man and standing down. But they wouldn't actually be able to stop him from running for re-election, which is just a crazy situation that you know someone's going to be investigated for expenses fraud, and you know they're given the opportunity to do the same thing again, basically.
If people want to keep an eye on this, I'm just looking on this Daily Mirror explainer, which I said really good piece from them, and it says that the latest possible deadline for candidates to file their nomination papers for the general election is May the 12th. So we have to wait in the run-up to May the 12th and see if the CPS announce any prosecutions. And then we have to see what those MPs' reactions are. If it goes past May the 12th and we've only had like two or three, or maybe zero, fingered by the CPS, well, then we have to be really waiting then to see what happens. Because they did say that the announcements should be made before the vote itself. So it's going to be very interesting if it's in that interim period. The Daily Mirror has basically taken the line that it could be a tremendous miscalculation. It might have seemed like a wheeze in terms of, offsetting or thwarting the outcome of these investigations into election spending. But the Daily Mirror has also got some kind of counter view saying, actually, could make it even worse if these MPs are suddenly in the firing line for prosecutions while the election campaign is kind of raging.
Yeah, and I think there is going to be a likelihood that at least several out of those possibly 30 individuals, in the understanding that I had, only 12 out of the 30 individuals were MPs, and the rest were like, you know, kind of backroom staff or civil servants or whatever. So it's interesting that the actual list has come out now, and it's close to, you say it's 30 MPs. That's more than in any report that I've come across that says.
We should also mention that the evidence is basically there to prosecute them. The CPS could make the case that they're unlikely to secure a successful conviction or conduct a successful prosecution. So that's one way out. But the Tories have already been fined £70,000 by the Electoral Commission for their shenanigans at the last election. So these prosecutions follow up on that. So clearly, if they're found guilty of wrongdoing by the Electoral Commission, then these police investigations, which are triggered on the back of that, they're hardly not going to turn up anything. The evidence is not in question that it's there. The sticking point is, will the CPS carry these cases forward? I think you're more optimistic than me. I don't really believe that many of them will go forwards now.
Well, I know that some of them...
I'd be very surprised.
Well, some of them had suggested that the CPS are now going to have to rush around to inform these people whether they're going to prosecute them before June 8th. So if that is indeed the case, you know, this won't have to play out too long before we understand who's going to be prosecuted and who of these people are going to be standing for re-election. I mean, there's something to be said for the state of the political affairs of your country when the people that you've got the opportunity to vote for are being investigated for fraud. And fraud being specifically to do with why they're in that position in the first place. You know, it's bizarre that we're in this. I suppose some would suggest it's never changed. This has always been the case. It's really blatant now.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it? We may be finding that some of the names on this list of 30 suddenly discover a previously hidden desire to spend much more time with their families.
That's usually what happens, isn't it? Is that they suddenly retire. I mean, was it George Osborne? He's just left politics. He's going to stop being an MP to concentrate on his newspaper career. Right? So, yeah, good luck with that, George.
Well, today he was threatening to return to politics.
He's all over the place, he's old George. Who he doesn't knows? Know where he's coming or going.
Well, he's just the luckiest man in the world, isn't he, really? He wakes up every day, he can't believe his luck. Put his ATM card into the cash point and do a balance inquiry. And when it comes up with the string of zeros on the thing, he must be like, he just can't believe his luck. I'm George Osborne.
I had a little leprechaun there just for a minute.
Well, he is Irish gentry, isn't he, his heritage? Oh. So that was not intended as a kind of slur on Irish people. That was only directed at George Osborne himself.
You got a problem with leprechauns, Jay?
No, have you? Nothing on
that. You got vertically
any
challenged.
Leprechauns are listening, well, they probably make up more than half of our audience.
Along with the fairies and Santa.
That's right. Easter Bunny's tuning in this week.
So there was, within like these... If this election goes forward and we've got this constant background noise going on where we've got the Labour Party busily trying to undermine Jeremy Corbyn, we've got an awful lot of the Tory MPs that are up for re-election possibly being investigated for this fraud election. There is no other part. And then we've got the bod out of the Liberal Democrats suggesting that it's not beyond the pale for them to go into another coalition, right? So it just seems to be going around in circles and we're going down the plug hole. Is there a way out, do you think, Jay? Or have we just got to sit here and watch the show unfold?
Well, no. The audience finds itself on the stage, as I quoted from one of my favourite Ultravox songs. The audience finds itself on the stage again. The public can make a difference here.
Right.
The difference would be, like him or not, I don't think he's the best leader the Labour Party have ever had. He's certainly not the worst, though.
No.
And he's up against a party that I believe a government that is really, truly taking the country drastically in the wrong direction. I can't really personally see any reason to vote for the Conservatives unless you're a millionaire. There's just no reason. None of their policies benefit people that just go out and work every day and just live month to month like the majority do. None of those policies benefit those people at all. If you've got lots of money and the Tories are going to protect you by helping you pay as little tax as possible and shuffle it around and hold on to your wedge if that's the thing that matters to you most in life, then sure, it's no problem for you to vote for them. But for the average person, I think the Tories are just completely destroying the quality of life for people in Britain. I say quality of life, it depends, doesn't it? If you're at a certain level of the economy, then maybe the Tories are just not doing you too many favours. But if you're anywhere towards the bottom, the Tories are actively seeking to crush you, to annihilate you. It doesn't seem a week goes by without people just throwing themselves off bridges. I mentioned investment bankers throwing themselves out of hotel windows when they lose all their money. But you've got these instances where the Tories' policies are biting so hard on people with mental health problems or disabilities, people who do need assistance, that these people are kind of taking matters into their own hands and hurting themselves. No one seems to really, government seems to really care about that. Even if it was just to save these critical services from being decimated, it would be worth voting for Jeremy Corbyn. I can't go along with Dan Hodges' view there. This is the most heartless government I've seen in my time. They've all been much of a stripe, haven't they, these Conservative governments? Whether it was, who was it, John Major in charge, or Margaret Thatcher, or David Cameron, and now Theresa May. There's no real mystery to what the Tory party do when they're in office.
Right.
So I do believe that there's a genuine choice there. So it's important for people that Jeremy Corbyn does win.
Right. Hold on, Charlie. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a piece of music. I'm going to call you back on Skype because your line's breaking up a little bit. I'll give you a call back in a second. I'll just play a piece of music and then.
Wait down and tell the people about the mythical things coming your way.
No.
I think we've managed to sort out the Skype issues. Hello, Jay.
Hi there, Dave. That beautiful music there, Dave.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I faded it out. It's all right.
It's good. It's good stuff. I was just getting more angry as I was being reconnected there on the Skype, just thinking about the differences between the Tories and the Labour Party there with Jeremy Corbyn at the helm. You said, it really is amazing that people would not vote for Labour on the basis of who their leader is.
Yeah, yeah.
Considering what that means in terms of this Conservative government being given even more of a mandate for their programme.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see people start touting on social media to vote for Conservatives, and especially if they then link in the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is allegedly unelectable. And I know people that have said that to me personally and have no time for him whatsoever. So whether those people would really seriously consider voting for the Tories and everything that they sort of stand for, it's a very strange situation to be in, to see people change, you know, tactical voting to all intents and purposes.
I have a quote here, actually, which I dug out for today.
Right.
Which might kind of... You said there's kind of confusion in terms of what's going around with the political situation at the moment. Turmoil is one of the words most often employed to describe what's going on in the country. But I have this... it's an article. I don't know if you know this writer. He's called Thomas Mann.
I'm not familiar with him, no. Explain.
Well, he was probably one of the most famous writers in the world at one point. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's a German writer. And my book that I've got is, I found it in the used bookstores here. I did tell you that I explore these. That's part. Yeah. That's really my favorite activity at the weekends. It's called Voices Against Tyranny. And these are writings about the Spanish Civil War. And this was published like 50 years after the Spanish Civil War. So it just collects together different artists giving their thoughts on the war. And Thomas Mann's piece is really interesting. And he contrasts two things. He contrasts the spirit with interest. So he's got this opposition there. And he's talking firstly about this idea that artists shouldn't speak out on political matters and that they shouldn't kind of lower themselves into the political arena and begin, you know, kind of expressing themselves. We do sometimes hear that, especially in America, you know, the traditional conservative dislike of Hollywood celebrities speaking out on political issues. So he's kind of speaking to that. And he offers his definition of what the spiritual is as contrasted with interest. Okay. And he says the spirit is the longing of the people for better, juster, happier conditions of life, more adequate to the developed human consciousness. It is this longing affirmed by all those who are of goodwill. And interest is all that which seeks to thwart this consummation, because it would thereby be cut off from certain advantages and privileges, seeks by every means at its command, not scorning the basest, even the criminal, or, well knowing that in the long run it must fail, tries to put off as long as it can the evil day for a little while, for a few decades. And to me, you know, if you listen to that, the Tories represent interest, don't they? And the newspapers that support them, they are this defense of advantages and privileges. We did play the Katie Hopkins video over a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Her voice is the kind of unvarnished, brazen, open form of this this interest. She's unashamed. And the Daily Mail's kind of unashamed too, as are the Express and Telegraph. And as it says there, you know, they won't stop at anything. It doesn't matter how base, it doesn't matter if it's criminal. As we see, we've just been talking there about the election fraud. The Conservative Party, and I'm sure you know this, Dave, the Conservative Party Central Office frustrated this Electoral Commission investigation at every single turn. And they employed their top lawyers to do everything possible to get out of these charges. And at the end of that, Theresa May had the nerve to utter a complete falsehood on national media that she wasn't challenged for, when she said that the Conservative Party cooperated fully with that investigation. That is a lie.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, with our rather servile media, in the mainstream media, she was not. She did not suffer any damage at all for that falsehood. And she knows that wasn't true. But how much of the audience knows that wasn't true? But it just shows, you know, that they will literally stop at nothing. I'm not saying Labour is the answer to all of our problems, but we do seem to be in a situation where they're so terrified of the fact that Jeremy Corbyn actually is something genuinely different that the public are not going to be allowed really to hear him and hear his message and hear his ideas. Most of his ideas are very popular when they take the Jeremy Corbyn label away and just run them by people in these polls. It's just that the media has done such a successful job of making people believe that Corbyn is a failure and a loser, unelectable and not statesmanlike, that as soon as you put the Jeremy Corbyn name back on, the brand is kind of toxic. But to me, that's not Jeremy Corbyn's fault. It's nothing really inside Jeremy Corbyn. It's more just this constant background of demonization of him. I think you can certainly see, can't you, Dave, that if we turned it around, we could very easily demonize Theresa May. If yeah. if she was on the other side and all the newspapers were left wing, it would be hard to demonize Theresa May and make her look ghastly. Her visual appearance is kind of frightening.
The leather trousers.
The kind of wide-eyed wild stare. In the last days of the Thatcher government, spitting image, they had, like, I think they had 7 or 8 Thatcher puppets. One where the eyes were...
There's an 80s, hang on, Jay. There's an 80s reference there you've just thrown out, spitting image. Maybe you should put some flesh on the bones of that one. What is spitting image, in case people are not familiar with it?
Well, for anyone who wasn't born before 1979...
It might be.
Some of you fairies and elves and hobbits that are tuning in tonight may be still in short trousers. Spitting image was a topical sketch show, which was really, at one time, it was probably the one thing on TV worth watching. And it did play a part in the political culture because so many people were tuning in. And these were the days before video recorders were not a big thing back then. And you still had basically your four channels. So people would tune in live for the latest installment of Spitting Image. And it was capable of shaping public opinion of politicians. And it was... it was savage and relentless in terms of what they did to politicians. I think my own favorite one, and again, we're going down memory lane here, was that at that time you had the SDP, who became known as kind of the SDLP. Now, this is a forgotten political party now, but they did enjoy a kind of day in the sun briefly. They had two leaders of their party. It was kind of preposterous, wasn't it? They had two leaders. It's like that animal in the Dr. Dolittle stories with the two heads that likes to walk in different directions. I think it's called the push me, pull you. So they had one called David Owen and they had another called David Steele. Now, Spitting Image had a kind of regular sized David Owen, and then they produced this tiny, tiny David Steele who would sit on his knee like a ventriloquist dummy, and they would debate things together. But, you know, David Owen was this kind of very clever Svengali type figure. So at the end, they were devastating throughout the Thatcher years. They were brilliant. And they had writers like Ben Elton was on that show. Lots of good comedy writers. And as you can testify, Dave, along with the young ones, it was absolutely essential television. And it did have a kind of anarchic spirit.
Yeah, totally. It was... current affairs with a little bit of edgy humour that really...
There was one sketch I remember. They were doing the voice coaching for Margaret Thatcher because, of course, you know, she was... It was an effort for her to kind of sound restrained because she was, by her nature, kind of a very forceful figure. And so she had her way of very odd-mannered way of speaking that developed throughout her political career. So they had this kind of voice coach talking to her, and she was kind of talking in her normal voice, and then the voice coach was kind of butting in, but he's kind of oily. And I remember him saying to her, "Margaret, Margaret now." He said, "Margaret, I want to hear velvet, Margaret. I want to hear velvet, not sandpaper." So this was the kind of full-on attack on like each part of them. But the Theresa May looks like end-stage Thatcher with eyes like the robot from Westworld, just intent on, you know, firing laser beams and murdering all her opponents.
I'm in that final Thatcher phase.
That was brilliant, wasn't it?
Is it terminal?
It is terminal if the Tories win again. I really don't know what to say.
Yeah, well,
like you said, Dave, you framed it very well, because we're kind of in this situation where I think people are desperate actually for a change, but we've been programmed that although Jeremy Corbyn does represent change, it's a change that is not going to be.
It's not the right change.
Introduced to the British people in any meaningful way. It's often been said, hasn't it, that he's a very ineffectual communicator. But anyone would be ineffectual if, in effect, your microphone's been switched off by the guys that, you know, have their fingers on the power supply. And that's what's going on with Jeremy Corbyn. We had a case here in Taiwan. A Taiwanese pop star went over to China, and they were at an awards ceremony, and they were doing their little speech, and they began to talk about Taiwan. And yeah, sure enough, as they began to speak about Taiwan, microphone went off. You know, that's power. The guy with the techie with his finger on the power switch, that's power. Not the person out front with all the people watching you on stage. No. So Jeremy Corbyn's message, it's not that he's really bad at communicating it. It's just they're making damn sure it can't get out.
You're going to ask Mariah Carey about that one. She had a recent recent experience with a dodgy sound man.
What was this?
Oh, God, didn't you hear about it? She was doing it.
I'm not up to speed with
With Mariah.
Mariah Carey story.
Yeah, well, you're at that age now. You kind of let the attention go where it comes to the pop culture. But, yeah, basically...
Actually, Julia's last song there, she had that Maria McKee, you see. Now, I do know a lot about this kind of popular culture. I do know a lot about hit songs.
You sound like it's 1990. Like, I'm not as old as you think I am. I do know about pop music.
Is I will explain why I don't like Mariah Carey very much. And I really didn't like that Maria McKee song. Now, my mum loved that Maria McKee song, my departed mother. But I did make the comment when hearing that kind of singing that, you know, I like singing that comes from the lungs, not from the ovaries. And that's what it sounds like with that kind of...
Oh, it's a new interesting technique for singing. Yeah, what happened with Mariah Carey was that she was doing a gig on... it was being televised on Fox News. And it... There was no sound. And so she stopped miming. She was basically speaking through the microphone, saying to everyone, yeah, this is not working, this is stupid, so I'll just go through the motions. And yeah, and then one of the dancers came up behind her and she turned to him through the microphone and said, yeah, pick me up, we can try a lift. All of which was going out, you know. And so it was just absolute. And then afterwards, the fight, well, I won't get into all that because it's nonsense, but... Yeah, the sound man ruled that day.
Well, it's funny you bring her up, though. She's on the show next week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she's doing smaller gigs now.
I was thinking about how to increase our number of listeners.
Yeah.
So one thing that I did come up with was we could make these simply untrue promises, a little like the Conservative Party will during the next 5 weeks.
Okay.
Vote for us, you'll have a pony, you'll be able to afford to buy a house. You'll be able to retire before you're 104 years old. I'm really looking forward to the manifestos when they come out. But as I say, if you can't beat them, join them, Dave. So we may as well announce our guests for next week. We're going to have Mariah Carey on. Yeah. Who else?
Elvis.
Elvis will make an appearance.
Elvis, yes, he will be dropping in.
Right, talking of Elvis.
Shawaddy Waddy.
Oh, God.
The drummer from Shawaddy Waddy will be here with us. He'll be discussing the latest political news to a backbeat.
Yeah, he'll be sitting next to the fellow out of Black Lace.
Oh, yeah, the one who looked like a skeleton, yeah. He won't be you're not allowed to put him too near the light or you can kind of see through him.
So thin, he's transparent.
Actually, the Black Lace guy, though, I will give him his due. I was staying in a hotel up north one time when I was doing my in another life doing my job, and I was trying to get to sleep. I think it was in Leeds, and I could hear this noise coming from the room next door, and it sounded like someone was having the mother of all parties in that room. Just this kind of shouty voices and all this music playing. It was like, wow, that sounds good. Then I realized the penny drops. It's the scene from Rita, Sue and Bob 2, one of my favourite movies. And it's the bit with Black Lace doing We're Having a Gangbang. Oh. Are you familiar with this?
No, I've seemed to have missed out on this cultural phenomenon.
Well, when the Black Lace chap comes on the show next week, perhaps he'll do a cappella rendition with me of We're Having a Gangbang.
Right. And it's all moving from Black Lace and gangbangs, because, you know, very easily.
Put that on the tags for the show this week, Dave. Gangbang, conspiracy, political debate, and opinion.
Someone's got an entertaining story about Black Lace.
A true story about one of the guys out of Black Lace, yeah.
Right, well, go on then. Explain.
I hope it's not going to be liable.
A friend of mine's sister, one of her friends years ago, went out. And anyway, she ended up trapping off with one of the guys from Black Lace.
All right.
And that's it. But there was more to the story, but I'm not going to say it.
You'll find out next week.
Yeah, yeah. There's a teaser right there.
Yeah, basically, later on, she found...
Black Lace.
I would have changed.
Yeah, later on, she found a friend. And she turns around and said, you know, what have you been up to? And she basically turned around and said, the man from Black Lace.
Right?
Well, there you go. Someone's got an extra
the
little bit
of... Black Lace did something that would make Jimmy Savile blush by the sound of it.
It was like, oh, it was such a build-up when it was like, but I can't tell you that really funny bit.
It was that period when actually a woman's dream was the man from Milk Tray. You'd be pretty unhappy if it turned out to be the man from Black Lace, wouldn't you? I don't know what he'd be leaving on your pillow.
Yeah. No, we'll leave that there.
I dare not entertain the...
Right, I mean, so we were going to be moving on to like the mad crazy fiasco that is the standoff with North Korea, but after talking about Black Lace,
nuclear annihilation after Black Lace doesn't sound so bad.
No, well, if we're going to go, let's make sure we've got some kicking Black Lace tunes playing.
Said, bring it on.
Right, so there's a couple of things that are connected here. Well, Trump being the central figure, because obviously with Syria and now with North Korea. Where do you want to start with this, Jane? There's a lot of stuff in there, really.
Well, the first thing I have to do is, like you said, you know, you get those things on TV when the Michael Burke, is he still doing the news, Michael Burke, or Who Edwards?
Who?
They do that thing where their face suddenly changes to the very serious face, and then they'll say, a bomb, you know, like that. So they're trained to do that by the BBC. They practice going from very trivial stories to the very serious stories so they can flip backwards and forwards. Now, I haven't had that kind of training, so I'm just going to kind of breathe in and out a few times before we talk about North Korea after Black Lace.
And breathe. Okay.
I'll invite the audience to breathe along with me. Now, I will say on a perfectly serious note that the night before North Korea's National Day, when all the talk had been about if they would try one of these missile tests, and it wasn't actually a test of a nuclear missile, it was just a test of a conventional missile. It kind of got conflated that it was a nuclear test. I don't think it was. But I did go to bed thinking, what kind of world am I going to wake up in tomorrow? Am I going to wake up and find that the whole country has been destroyed? I really did have that feeling going through me. I'm not that far away here in Taiwan. I'm not saying I'd hear the bombs hitting, but it certainly made me worry for what was going to happen. And, of course, open my eyes first thing in the morning and check. And to the world's great relief, this kind of rocket just completely fizzled out. It was kind of win, what would we say? Lose. A loss for North Korea, but a win for the rest of us that just want to breathe.
But you see, you've got Trump and you've also got Pence. Pence was doing a speech on some American aircraft carrier a few days ago, and he was suggesting that, you know, if there's the fight to be taken, that America will take it up. And then you've got Trump saying, if they're looking for trouble, they found it. I mean, this is like kind of the bully tactics. It's the bully tactics.
It truly is those bullying tactics, as you say. And considering North Korea is already has a paranoid leadership, doesn't seem to me to be the right approach. The right approach is, like it or not, to try and de-escalate, to try and bring calm back to this region. As North Korea said themselves, the US seems intent on inflaming the situation at the moment. Again, we're back to one of these things where the US is going to act in whichever way it seems fit, it seems. And the rest of us, no matter how misguided we might believe it to be, just have to we do have to spectate in these circumstances. I really hope something changes to reduce the tension there. But as you said, Mike Pence made his statement that the time for strategic patience is over. Trump told them on Twitter that they've got to behave, which Twitter now seems to be the new communication platform for global statesmanship as regards the US.
Yeah.
This late stage. I did look up today. If people wonder why North Korea is quite so paranoid, it's interesting. If you type into Google how many Koreans died in the Korean War, then the answer that comes up straight away is how many Americans died is the first page, just dominated by that. So you actually find out, oh, only 5,000 people died. That's interesting. Oh, 5,000 Americans. If you go down onto page 2, you'll find out that the actual estimate is about 1.2 million Koreans died in that war.
As opposed to 5,000 Americans.
As opposed to 5,000 Americans. The point being, apart from the, you know, the great disparity as usual there in terms of US dead and America's victims, is scars like that are not going to heal overnight. It doesn't matter that it was 60, 70 years ago. It's not hard to understand why there's still a huge amount of anti-American feeling and paranoia in North Korea. And you can understand why they don't really want to back down in the face of the US returning, as you said, in this bullying manner. The US, actually, I say returning, the US has never left the scene of these events. Oh, you see, the US has simply installed itself on the other side of the DMZ and said, well, we're here in perpetuity because we signed this bit of paper with South Korea. On we go.
Yeah, because you, and at the same time, you've got Trump and Pence doing this stuff. You've also got various dignitaries in North Korea, such as the UN ambassador, Kim In-ryung, saying that the world's biggest hotspot is North Korea, the peninsula, because of the way America's been treating them, and creating a dangerous situation in which a thermonuclear war may break out at any moment, and is ready to react to any mode of war desired by the US. So it's going to be tit for tat, isn't it? Whatever stakes the Americans raise up, North Korea is going to do the same thing. How long does this go on for until they get a weapon that can travel?
Obviously, it's going to carry on, isn't it? Until they are going to get those weapons one day. It would be better to try and divert them from this course, but if they've been frozen out largely out of the international community, then what real choices have they got? And it's really only if they have this kind of option, that may be, in terms of how they see it, that is the thing keeping the Americans at arm's length, is developing these weapons. It's kind of similar situation that Iran has found itself in, where, you know, they kind of feel that they need that nuclear program because without it they're simply going to be attacked. So it's this kind of, it's a defensive measure. But of course, the way the US sees the world is anyone increasing their ability to withstand a US attack, that is what the US terms hostile. When other countries bolster their defenses, the US always interprets that as an act of aggression. That's the way they want to shape our view of the world too. You know, so that's the way the news networks disseminate it. It's interesting that as the Koreans were testing that missile, if you go and look it up online, Americans were testing nuclear weapons the same week.
Right, hold on, Jay. We have someone in the studio who just wants to quickly say something on that.
Hi there, Jay. My name is Daniel. For anyone listening, just want to give a quick insight in that on the bully theory that you just explained. When any country is boosting up the defense, America sees that because they know what they've done. That, like, throughout history, they know that they know the error they've been doing to a lot of different nations. So they are just waiting for the karma to come back to them. So when they see anyone building up defenses, they be like, oh, maybe it's for us. Maybe they're getting ready. Because the karma of America is long due.
I would agree with that.
That's a fair point. And one word that's used for karma here is blowback. I don't know how familiar you are with that term.
But
the idea of blowback is, it's from covert operations. So the Americans have a covert operation, and the blowback are kind of the visible consequences. So, for example, the classic example is the coup in Iran in 1953. The blowback from that was the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Mm-hmm. That's one example. Now, if we take a more recent example, and I'm sure Daniel might know this, but if he doesn't, he's going to laugh because of the karma part. The mother of all bombs that was dropped on Afghanistan.
Yes.
The tunnel complex that was bombed was built with CIA money.
Yeah.
So they destroyed their own.
We're deep into this, you know, you act and then you unleash chain of consequences, and then you're kind of acting again. You're kind of encountering yourself at every kind of turn. Past policies turn into, you know, headaches again in the present because the US fingerprints are kind of all over everything.
Now, do you remember last week, Jay, when we were part of the show, we were discussing that when America decides to go to an act of war, the Constitution says that they have to go via the Congress, and it's Congress that issues the act, the Powers Act. And I suggested that it was actually the UN. Well, I managed to hunt down the clip where this is explained.
Without Congress to initiate a no-fly zone in Syria without congressional approval.
You know, again, our goal would be to seek international permission, and we would come to the Congress and inform you and determine how best to approach this, whether or not we would want to get permission from the Congress. I think those are issues we would have to discuss as we decide what to do here.
Well, I'm almost breathless about that, because what I heard you say is we're going to seek international approval, and they will come and tell the Congress what we might do, and we might seek congressional approval.
Right, so who you was listening to there was Senator Sessions asking Leon Panetta, who was the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Obama, basically stating on record in front of the Congress that they don't need to get the Americans' permission. If the UN decide to go to war, then they will go to war. Which, as the guy said, Sessions, it's quite striking that actually the hubris of these people. We will do whatever we want.
There's another example where NATO was initiated a conflict, initiated an intervention. That was used. I believe it may have been the Kosovo intervention. Right. The US was kind of dithering there. Suddenly NATO declares its mission, starts striking Kosovo. And of course, the US is, you know, a central member of NATO. So then the US kind of follows along with it. Yeah, as you say, I'm not really, as we've said on previous shows, it doesn't really matter to me that they consult the Congress. It doesn't matter to me that they have a vote. It doesn't matter to me that they say that it's legal. I'm not really interested in that. At the end of it, and I do believe you have a good article that leads into this idea, it's simply an act of war. How would we feel in Britain if Libyan legislators or Syrian legislators, or for example, some African state, met and they all discussed it and they all voted and it was all legal in the African legal system, their country, it was all legal. But they agreed that they needed to intervene in Britain, and they decided they're going to launch airstrikes on London and Birmingham and Manchester. No one would care that it was all legal. No one would care that someone voted for it. It would not be considered anything other than what it is, an act of war. So no, it doesn't interest me in the slightest. Democrats are famous for this. They won't disagree on the actual military action, but they'll be saying, oh, no, but we must. It must go through Congress. Oh, we must have a vote. Oh, it must be all the I's and the T's, you know, dot the I's and cross the T's. Must all be signed off and legal. Yeah, so what? Makes no difference at all to the people who are being attacked. None at all. Oh, my goodness, my family were killed by a perfectly legal airstrike. You know, it doesn't make any difference.
Right, and that's interesting, because I know we were talking the other day that, to all intents and purposes, what's going on here are acts of war. I mean, Obama did it. Obama had a kill list. He would attack people all over the place in using his drones, right? Now, what's quite interesting is that there is a certain kind of terminology that seems to be used here. Instead of saying an act of war, you know, if you drop bombs on another country, that in itself is an act of war. But we get really interesting terms like military action. Military operation, the classic humanitarian.
An intervention.
Humanitarian intervention. And
no fly zone.
Kinetic.
No fly zone means endless NATO bombing missions.
Yeah. What I thought was funny, the best one, was kinetic. When someone used the term kinetic action, and then someone said, we're going to drop some kinetic love bombs.
It's just,
oh dear. You hear that kinetic operations? I was thinking of that myself. That is these one thing that happens is that as journalists were embedded with the military during, well, going right back to the Vietnam War, but each time we have one of these new kind of signature invasions by American forces, these embedded journalists pass this military jargon back into the mainstream, you know, because they pick up on it every day at these briefings. So that's why suddenly some guy at the Washington Post who was embedded for a few weeks in Afghanistan is writing about kinetic operations.
Yeah, it was
op-ed.
It was a guy called Bob Woodward who was, you know, 2002 he came up, and he used it as a euphemism, basically, right? But then you've got Obama, with Trump attacking Syria, you've got then people coming out suggesting this is the day that he became president, which is crazy. But you've got people saying, well, this shows Obama's reluctance to use weapons. Well, let's just look at the reluctance, because from the last count, he bombed 9 countries, right? Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and the Central African Republic and the Philippines. This is the man who got Nobel Peace Prize and yet attacked 9 countries. And yet now he's being propagated as the man who stepped back. Now, what's interesting with that is that Clapper, who was in his government, basically James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, he suggested, when the 2013 episode came up of Syria allegedly using chemical weapons, sarin gas in this case, that the evidence, the intelligence, was not a slam dunk. And so James Clapper suggested to Obama, who was ready to push the button, that maybe he shouldn't do it. And actually, Obama held off. Well, then the scenario with Trump seemingly falling for this trick, and now he's in it, and maybe there is no way out, who knows? But we're now in this situation where things are ramping up by the day, if not, you know, by the minute, with these little Twitter outbursts that we're getting off the guy. So, Dan has something.
So it's my first time doing this type of show, so I lost my manners. I didn't say hi to Jay.
No problem.
And but I just want to go in retrospective a little bit. Yeah. America kind of plays when it comes to these power moves and military actions, as they say.
Yeah,
they often play the villain and the savior at the same time. I don't know if you noticed that.
Right.
And majority of European countries, they have military bases.
Yeah.
And they're like, so it's almost like they, how can I say, they waiting for something to happen so they can be there straight away. You know, you know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that they do.
They're like oversee, like.
What's interesting with that is that Trump currently is basically going around, and it was part of his electioneering, that he was going to make all these countries who have, where American bases reside, he was going to make them pay. Right, in order to keep these.
Well, we did discuss this on a previous show, right, Dave. And actually, the bases in Japan, the Japanese do pay.
Right, and
to host those bases, and to just pick up on what Daniel said there, we're always told that the U.S. forces are stationed there in Europe for Europe's defense. But I think Daniel's point is that the double-edged nature of it is that also means that the U.S. is dominating those European countries too. What would be the strongest nation in Europe militarily would be Germany. But the U.S. has its largest force in Europe stationed in Germany. It's this kind of thing that they're there cancelling out the abilities of their allies to kind of develop their own centers of military strength.
So, okay, with specifics then, when it comes to this recent Syrian attack, there's been some new information come out by an MIT professor, I believe, who has gone across this so-called evidence that the White House has released, saying that, you know, we played a clip last week of John Kerry that was going on saying, we actually physically saw the rockets leave here, fly over here and land here. We know it's him. We know it's him. And then a little while later, literally within weeks, it found out that it wasn't him. It was the rebels.
And it seems that the same kind of thing has happened again with this one. The only difference is Trump fired off 53 Tomahawks? 59.
But the funny thing about...
Supposedly only 30 hit the target.
So, yeah, it's still good.
But the thing about the Syria situation is there's a lot of powers at work.
Yeah.
Some that shouldn't even be there, to be
America
honest.
Being one of them.
Yeah. They kind of... I think they played the key part of why this gone south. Because they trained the rebels.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't Hillary... I think... Was it Hillary?
Who? Yeah, Hillary was co-funding.
Yeah, she funded the rebels. So who did the attack again? The rebels?
Yeah, well, from all accounts, it's a... Well, the 2013 account was that it was the rebels.
So,
and actually, the sarin used wasn't part of Assad's stockpile. It was more the homegrown variety of sarin.
But this is what I mean.
Homebrew.
Why would Assad, being in the position where he is, you know, why would he bomb his own people?
No, but this is what the mainstream want you to believe.
Yeah.
A completely nonsensical, illogical outcome would be he's in a situation where he's winning and yet he does this to sabotage himself.
Why?
Exactly.
It hasn't really taken there, Dave, with the idea that Assad is, like, deranged like Saddam Hussein.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but, you know, there they would have played the kind of he's mad, what can you expect? A madman will do all kinds of illogical
things. They're
doing that
with Kim Jong-il.
But with Assad, that narrative has never really taken hold. Instead, Assad is a butcher. You know, it's this. He's the cynical killer, the cynical mass murderer. But they haven't really managed to pass him off as a madman.
No. Isn't it? Because it makes no sense. Because they already gave him the green card to, like, be in power. They already told him, yeah. Like, America said, yeah, we have no... problem would you be an empire?
No, well, this is the thing in Syria, is women were they were allowed to be participants within society, whereas at the moment we're funding Saudi Arabia to attack Yemen, and women are not even allowed to drive cars over there. So there's a real discrepancy. One person they will call a beast and an animal, and another one who may even act closer to that than anyone else, but yet they're our allies. So there's a completely... disconnect. Yeah, it's who's pays, basically.
It's conveniency.
Right. Yeah, simply the interest. They do say Syria was the last Muslim country in the Middle East where you could consume alcohol, you know, at your leisure. You know, it's the most open of these societies. And as you said, the Theresa May and the US have no trouble at all with the butchers in Saudi Arabia. And UAE and Bahrain, and they don't have any problem at all. But suddenly, if someone is developing their own kind of position of strength, that's, as we said, immediately interpreted as a hostile act towards the US. The international community gets brought on board, this famous thing called the international community, and you're kind of pressured politically, economically, and finally, if that doesn't work, militarily. There's an excellent book maybe we should talk about on next week's show that looks at this. And have you heard of a man called John Perkins?
Not offhand.
Well, he did a great book, and it's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, I am familiar with the book. I've not read it, but I am familiar with it because it's, from all accounts, it's a fascinating book. Real
it is. And the good thing about that book is, one, it tours you around the world. So he goes off on his travels as his career develops. Just to give the background, he was kind of tapped and by the intelligence services, and he was introduced to this line of work. And he worked for what ostensibly was like an engineering consultancy company. But basically their job was to make developing countries take out these huge loans with the U.S., and to impoverish them, their populations, basically. But what he calls it is, he says that if these it was the classic, you know, I'll make you an offer you can't refuse. Any leader of one of these small developing countries that decided not to take them up on this offer to develop with their typical thing would be like a power network to improve the power grid in a country. If they refuse this, he calls them the jackals. You know, if you don't want to take the offer, then the jackals go in. And this is the operations to destabilize countries. And finally, if it's necessary, to take military action. I've got a site here that someone's done. It's a professor. WikiLeaks have been linking to it. And it just traces how many elections the US has interfered with that has kind of been documented. And they've come up with, well, actually, it's for you and Daniel. You know, we play, Daniel might not know this, but we do tend to do the guessing game thing. Have a guess how many elections the US has interfered with since 1946.
Since 1946? Oh, dear, right, okay.
Since 1946.
Until 2000.
Until 2000.
Right, so I'll throw out a figure then.
I'll go easy 30, easy 40.
What about you, Dave?
Easy.
120. 120, right, okay. I'll go for... This is going to probably
be... You got to go in the middle.
Yeah, I'll do 70. How many then, Jay?
80.
80?
Wow.
Right.
So I just want to put... just want to add to that. A lot of people, when they talk about African pirates and mercenaries, they are portrayed in the media as being black and, you know, being locals.
Yeah, yeah.
When really, if you go to Africa and, like, live there, I would say 3 months, you see a lot of blue, blonde-eyed American-speaking... they're not related to the army, you know what I mean? Walking around.
Right.
But there's a lot of pirates. I haven't seen a pirate, and I go on holidays quite often to Africa. And, like, obviously, west side, near Siberia, Guinea, that's the country. That's a country of my parents. And about 5 years ago, 5-10 years ago, there was a civil war there. There was never no pirates. That was just blue-eyed American-speaking mercenaries.
Yeah, and these would be the similar ones that we see on the back of Toyota trucks.
Yeah. So these are the same pirates that you see in the TV, but the ones you see in TV are black.
Yeah.
I've got another point there about these pirates. Is they're usually presented, aren't they, in their little, I think they call it like a skiff or something like this. Yeah. They're there on their little boats.
Yes.
And
yes.
They're presented to you as these kind of ragtag band with, it's all low tech.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pirates at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But I was reading about this very interestingly. A lot of the data on which ships to hit was being fed to the Somali pirates from the offices of shipping companies in the City of London. So it's an actual like globalized kind of operation in terms of using the latest technology to shuffle the information over to your pirates and have them carry out these missions. The British have been able to kind of make sure that British shipping is protected. They've taken those measures, but it's never quite as simple as it looks. It's a phenomenon of globalization as much as just some little local thing going on. It's not a throwback in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've
now another thing there which Daniel said I'd point out was there's a great book called Ghost Wars about the CIA's war in Afghanistan, and in that book, just as Daniel said there, In the 80s or in the late 90s, you know, someone be up on the side of a mountain somewhere in Afghanistan in some poppy field, and turn around the corner, and there's just a bunch of 6'5" blonde-haired, blue-eyed guys with builds like, you know, they're green berets.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's never just as simple as it looks. You see the same thing with the drugs trade in Latin America as well. The CIA. Kind of instrumental in that. We did mention Gary Webb on a previous show as well. He would be another person worth talking about, destroyed for basically bringing to light the fact that the CIA were instrumental in feeding crack cocaine into the black neighborhoods of California in the 1980s.
Yes.
The film, innit? American Gangster.
Yeah.
On that.
Yeah. They actually infiltrated. So basically they paid certain members of Black Panther to infiltrate. It's basically, they weren't members, but they were made to be members to infiltrate, you know, because that was the peak times where black people, consciously, they were banding together, fighting for the rights, you know, moving in an activist way. So them, instead of, like, continue with the police brutality, they said, hold on.
We'll just get them on drugs, yeah.
Because now we can get recorded and all of this. So now we're going to use their own people to go inside and start messing
up. Also did that within churches.
Yeah, churches, Black Panther activism buildings, loads of things. That's actually one of the CIA agents This was like a backdoor interview. It's on YouTube. I forgot the name, but I will link you to that, Dave. And he explains how he himself set fire to one of the places where Martin Luther King used to do speeches. He himself, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, well, this same kind of idea there of destroying communities or causing this kind of destabilization using drugs, since the war against the Taliban in 2001, there's been a huge expansion in the number of drug addicts in China, because all that Afghan opium has been pushed east and it's been used to destabilize China. Here in Taiwan, they say that 98% of the heroin that's seized in Taiwan, it's from Afghanistan. So this is another way that the CIA is the, you know, the master of the dark arts in terms of these kinds of operations. And that, to them, that is very satisfying, you know, to push the opium, take the profits, and then dump the social problems on one of your enemies. There's a part in the Steve Cole book in Ghost Wars where a CIA officer is basically jerking himself off, because he said, we've got Russians being killed with Chinese bullets. You know, he said you couldn't make it up. I mean, he's just got a hard on for the whole kind of activity. This is what these guys, this is bread and butter to these guys.
This is, that gives me the opportunity to play this.
Oh, those Russians.
took me ages to get that. But here you go. So, what we've got left? We've got 15 minutes.
We kind of dived into the dark.
Yeah,
the dark side of politics.
Just as a...
Well, I like listening to that stuff about Guinea there. I didn't know much about Guinea.
Yeah.
I did live in Guatemala, which was victim of a CIA-sponsored coup in 1954, and the country is still, you know, mired in the aftermath of that. That's why I made the point about North Korea. A war 60 years ago, it sounds like history book stuff, but actually the day-to-day lived reality, you know, these things are still going on. Yeah. They're still having their ripples.
Yeah. What amazes me is like how far the arm stretches. Because when Guinea was having this civil war, it was not... America didn't pick it up. England didn't pick it up. Portugal, they had to pick it up news-wise, because it's a colony. It's one of... Portugal colony, so they had the right. They had to do it. They had to cover it, and it's mad because there's a lot of countries in Africa that they're just being divided by Russians, Chinese, Americans. You know, like when it comes to fishing in fishing in the waters when they're not supposed to fish. You know, about 3 years ago. A cocaine boat sunk right in front of Guinea, and there was like tons of cocaine washing into the coast, and the locals did not know what that was, you know, and yeah, they was using it to cook.
That reminds me of another story there, Daniel. When I was in Guatemala, I was in Nicaragua and on a vacation, and I was reading about how they use these speedboats to smuggle cocaine along the coast of Nicaragua and try and get it to Guatemala, and then they'll fly it off to the States. But sometimes the U.S. Navy will come in and they'll disrupt these kinds of operations, or Nicaraguan army might kind of intervene, or the Navy, and they'll just kind of dump the cocaine over the side. So it will float in and it will just drift on the currents. And so there was this one little town where – just because of the way the currents drifted around, they'd been kind of blessed with all kinds of deliveries from the ocean. Wow. And they called it, this is really funny, the Spanish might be a little off, but it was something like Langosta Blanca, white lobster.
It would be the White Coast. Is White Coast?
No, sorry. No, the product was called White Lobster. It's what they called the cocaine. Because it's like, you know, a luxury item from the sea.
These cocaine packages
were called White Lobster. It's very amusing because if you've been to Nicaragua, you'll know the kind of state of the housing is not really that great in these little villages. But The locals had all built themselves like enormous villas on the seafront using this money. And the priest of the local church, the father there, said, well, what can I do? And he was busy taking loads of donations too. So they were like developing their whole oceanfront kind of
beachfront
property portfolio is on the back of this. But it's kind of perfect.
Crazy. That is great. That is a real free market.
Yeah.
Literally washing up out of the water on the beach, go and pick it up. There is one thing I'd like to mention just with in relation to the Trump and Syrian attack. An interesting little factor seems to have come out from a US official that the Russians had actually informed their US counterparts in Syria of the Syrian military plan to strike the warehouse 24 hours before it happened. Now, it's interesting that if that is indeed the case, how that has not been mentioned at all on the mainstream.
That is very interesting. The other thing you did there is you kind of undersold the MIT professor's report.
He really does
have incredible analysis of the photographs.
It is excellent.
You know, he really takes it apart. It wasn't, in his view, the way the sarin canister is crushed shows that was done using an explosive device on the outside of the canister, that it wasn't detonated from the inside. He said that the attack is not compatible with that. That would be launched by an aircraft. It's pretty definitively a ground-based munition. So he's got a really brilliant analysis. And the interesting thing, like you say, is one, it doesn't get reported. Two, it will not derail anything, will it? I was thinking of a good example for what's going on with the way the truth will keep circulating, but the mainstream narratives keep going. And the best I could come up with, maybe you and Daniel have seen it, is that movie Minority Report.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Really, what we're presenting on this show each week is the Minority Report.
Right.
It's the bit that has to be overlooked and has to be pushed away and denied, even when it just especially when it simply is true, factually true. But the mainstream media, it's just the majority report.
Well, it's like last week, wasn't it? I mentioned the story about possibly the website where people were to register before the referendum when it went down through sheer rate of traffic. But seemingly last week, some MPs thought that maybe a foreign power had hacked it. And then by the time I literally got back home from the studio, you had posted a story where Russia and China were mentioned as possibly hacking the website. I mean, this is within hours, man. Right? While World War III is going on around us, this is what we would hear from the mainstream, right?
The feeling is definitely there. It's a new morning in America. Fresh, vital. The old cynicism is gone. We have faith in our leaders. We're optimistic as to what becomes of it all. It really boils down to our ability to accept. We don't need pessimism. There are no limits.
It figures it would be something like this.
Yeah, so that's out of They Live, where you've got one of the chaps on the TV who's basically telling you to be... stay asleep, slave.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it reminds me there of, you know, the start of the movie Brazil, right, where they've got actually, he played one of the baddies in Porridge, for anyone who remembers. Oh, dear, I'm showing
Porridge.
Again.
Oh, there's a social reference from the 70s.
In Porridge, you had the kind of the leader, like the organized crim on the landing. And this guy was in the movie Brazil by Terry Gilliam. And at the start, they're kind of asking why there are all these terror attacks against Britain. And, you know, it's a little bit the same way things these days are all pinned on somehow in verses from the Quran are inspiring people to travel all the way from their Afghan hideouts to cause chaos in Piccadilly Square, when actually there are much more reasonable explanations closer to home. But again, they're part of the Minority Report.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, in Brazil, you just played your clip, but they say, what is it? And he says, I'll tell you what it is. Bad sportsmanship. That's the reason for the terror attacks. Bad sportsmanship. They simply can't hack seeing the other guy win. That was the terribly English explanation there for terror attacks. The government these days, they just prefer kind of the idea that they're madmen, or they're divinely inspired madmen, or they've been radicalized. in some way. Radicalized always seems to equate to having found out what's going on.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that...
You know, they always talk about radicalization, Dave. For example, they'll say they went to Syria to a training camp, or they went to Yemen to a training camp. Yeah, what if they just went to Yemen and just walked around?
Yeah.
And saw what was happening. If politicians do it, it's a fact-finding mission. If someone who's not happy with what UK foreign policy is, you know, it's a terrorist training camp.
Yeah, I mean, you said something to me the other day, Jay, where, and you touched upon it about 10 minutes ago, where, you know, no matter how what truth circulates, there is this agenda, the mainstream media seem to be pushing it, just as blind as what that little clip showed there, just, you know, any room, there's no room for cynicism or pessimism.
No.
We have this, there seems to be a plan drawn up to take on Syria in certain ways. Now, there was a situation some time ago with the France's former French minister, Roland Dumas, who stated in a TV interview, he was approached by the British government officials about preparations for the war in Syria 2 years prior to the start of the 2011 protests and conflict. And he went on TV, this is a French foreign minister, went on TV in France and told everyone that the British government had approached him 2 years before any unsettled activity happened in Syria.
Well, so this ties in with the part of our conversation, which was I said to you, you know, these things can't be arranged overnight. So exactly. There's a long lead up. There's a long lead up, which is under the surface. And all kinds of documents are available that show like the US, yeah, like destabilization methods.
Follow the
that
money,
they use.
Generally.
There's a guy called Gene Sharp, who's kind of his whole life is devoted to explaining, instructing people in regimes that the US wishes to turn, how to go about, you know, generating the circumstances for one of these color revolutions. So, of course, there's a long lead up. What we see is the little bit at the end when it comes into public view, when suddenly, you know, usually the US president or the State Department stick a timer on it and tell you, you know, when this timer gets down to the end, bzz, something's going to happen. You know, there's no time left. Yeah. On the Syria thing, there's not really a compelling argument to say that time is running out. As you pointed out, the Iraq one, weapons of mass destruction being launched. So that was the clock running down. In the Libya one, people of Benghazi being massacred. It's a genocide. You know, it's this kind of approach. So they usually try and stick a clock on it. One wheeze that they've got is they kind of use human rights as a way to mobilize people, so people feel noble about these.
We must protect the children.
So one thing we'll get is, you know, we're saving all the women and children of Benghazi. So that should bring some left-wing idiots on side.
Yeah.
I don't mean if you're left-wing, you're an idiot. But I just mean idiots who happen to be left-wing.
Well, if you're an idiot, you're probably left-wing.
Get sucked in. Yeah, we were told, weren't we, how many women and children it was going to save. My understanding is that although the bombs that NATO drop are highly developed, you know, technologically sophisticated, as yet they don't discriminate on the basis of gender, who they blow to pieces. So Hillary Clinton, in all her enthusiasm there and her championing of women's rights, when she's not making widows of women, she's making mincemeat of them, literally.
Which, wow. You know, interestingly enough, you touched upon that sort of the transgender language thing there briefly. I was having a conversation with my contact in Finland a few days ago, and she pointed out the Finnish language, the word han, is H-A with an accent over it, N, is the word that's used for basically male and female. But it's kind of already in the centre. It cannot be used any other way. So my questions to my contact in Finland was, how would then this sort of transgendered agenda affect itself in Finland if they can't start arguing over what word you use or what word you identify with? And she also pointed out an interesting fact. If I can wake up tomorrow and feel like I want to identify as a woman, how about if I wake up tomorrow and feel like I want to identify as a doctor? or a judge.
Or a chair.
Or indeed a chair.
Oh, we've had tables on the show, Daniel.
Yeah.
And actually, Daniel, I said I identified as a dog and I wanted to enter Crufts.
Yes.
And here we have...
I want the guy lifting up my tail and checking me out.
Where's going to put the rolls at?
Yes.
Oh, well, God, it's the guy from Black Lace.
He had to do something after Butlins.
Yes. I like how he linked that.
Right. Last time we left it on Katie Hopkins, which really put a downer on the show. So at least this week we have a picture of Jason receiving a rosette off of a member of Black Lace.
The skeleton looking one?
Excellent.
The skeleton looking one?
Yeah,
it's the skeleton one.
Turn sideways and it disappears. Right, I mean. Right, excellent. I think we'll leave it on that then, Jay. That's
marvellous. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Daniel.
Nice to meet you, Jay.
I would just like to say thank you to the guys in the studio. We have Dave and Daniel that joined us in today. So thank you very much, guys, for your input.
I was highly underprepared. I was no tabs, no nothing.
Just winging that's right. It's
thank rock you. And roll, thank man. You for having me, though.
Still that's good.
Yeah. No, it's interesting what you were saying there, Dan. Right, on that bombshell... We'll play out with some Pet Shop Boys.
Can I bark? Can you?
Starts to go walkies down.
Yeah. It's like.
Yeah, you've got to walk me after the show, Dave. Promised.
Right. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Thank you, everyone.
And Pet Shop Boys. No, we're not talking about gerbils. No. Okay. Take care, all. Speak to you soon.